I'll be here one radio last. Sorry for the kind of fits and starts there. But as we get into the life of Paul again, we're kind of coming to the conclusion. We're in the last few chapters of Acts. And if you recall, Paul has been arrested in Jerusalem. And then he has been brought from Jerusalem, the Bible says, down to Caesarea. Caesarea is actually north of Jerusalem, but, you know, as we talked about before, Scripture uses it's from topology, how they're referring to things, and Jerusalem is a very high altitude, and so you literally go down in altitude to Caesarea. Caesarea is named after Augustus Caesar by Herod the Great, city he built, and that is the capital of the province of Judea. And so Paul has been removed to be tried by Felix, the gentleman, the Roman governor of Judea, the one who's sitting in the same role that Pontius Pilate sat in for the crucifixion of Jesus. And we're going to start, and also too, does anyone recall there was a there were some folks that planned to kind of change the course of events before Paul left town. Does anyone remember what that was about?
The 40? You're talking about the 40?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you refresh us, Paul, kind of what happened there?
Well, they took a vow that he's not going to survive this.
Right. Yeah. And they had, the vow was actually pretty draconian. They said, we're not going to eat or drink. And that's a vow before the Lord until he's dead. So, that, you know, you have three guys that their whole lives were really. And in response to hearing about that plot, you can recall Claudius Lysias, the Roman commander, mounted a military guard of almost 500 Roman soldiers to get Paul out of Jerusalem to Caesarea. So they were very seriously.
In verse 14, it says, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul.
Correct.
Guess what happened to those 40?
Yeah. Believe it or not, actually, it's a good question, Paul. That question comes up a lot. And you remember that it was, as we see in the Gospels, rabbinic or Pharisaic Judaism is so regulatory. And remember, Jesus said that he accused the Pharisees that you bind all kinds of weights upon people. You don't use your own finger. You won't even lift them at all. And there were all kinds of exceptions. There was always exceptions to the rule. And so there's a lot of commentary on these guys probably sought out certain rabbinic rulings to get out of the vow so they didn't have to die. So
the comma was in the wrong space. Sorry.
Yeah, right. Okay, so let's go to Acts chapter 24. And this is Paul's defense before Governor Felix in Caesarea. And I think we've read this last time. I'll refresh this by reading verses 1 through 9. In verse 1, starting at chapter 24, says this. Now after 5 days, Ananias the high priest came down with the elders and a certain orator named Tertullus, and they came down from Jerusalem to Caesarea. They gave evidence to the governor against Paul. Verse 2, and when he was called upon, Tertullus began his accusation, saying, quote, seeing that though through you we enjoy great peace and prosperity is being brought to this nation by your foresight, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear, by your courtesy, a few words from us. Verse 5, for we have found this man a plague, a creator of dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to profane the temple, and we seized him, and wanted to judge him according to our law. Verse 7, but the commander Lysias came by, and with great violence took him out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come to you. By examining him yourself, you may ascertain all these things of which we accuse him. Verse 9, and the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so. So we talked last time about the fact that the priests and the elders, these are members of the Sanhedrin, come down to present this case before Felix, and they bring with them this guy named Tertullus, who's basically their attorney. He's their Johnny Cochran. And he's the guy they hire to present the case in this Roman legal proceeding. And Tertullus basically starts with his accusation, and Now we get into Paul's defense, which we're going to look at next here. So could someone read verses 10 through 21?
When the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship, neither in the temple nor in the synagogues nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot, nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked."
Okay, thank you. So, Paul starts his defense right away. Verse 10, because when the governor nodded for him to speak, Paul started. He begins his monologue. And he says in verse 11 that, you know, it was not even 2 weeks ago that he went to Jerusalem to worship. And he says in verse 12 that, look, I wasn't in the temple and the synagogues. I wasn't in any place causing a riot, he basically says. I didn't cause a riot at all, he says in verse 12. And then verse 13, he says something also pretty important with regard to his legal case. What does he say in verse 13 that's important to his legal defense?
You
can't prove anything. You can't just bring a charge and convict me. You got to bring proof of the charge. So that's very important in this whole discussion. They've got to prove the charge. And he says this, but I will admit this, verse 14. He says, what does he say in verse 14? Anyone want to paraphrase or summarize what he says in verse 14?
I think he's saying that he believes what was written by the prophets and he believes the law.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He says, what these guys believe, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe 100%. And but he says his belief is according to the way. See that?
Yes.
And how does the Sanhedrin characterize the way? They know the way.
It's a cult.
It's a cult, basically. That's exactly right. And Paul's point in verse 15 is that the way is the fulfillment of everything that these guys teach and believe, and the God of our fathers has handed down to us. And the way is a fulfillment of everything that's been given to the nation of Israel because of what has happened, and a core tenet of true of correct belief in what's been given to Israel. And he talks about this specific belief, and he mentions it in verse 15. You know what it is?
Resurrection.
That's right. Okay. So the Pharisees, remember, the Pharisees taught that the Hebrew Scriptures are very plain in teaching that there is a resurrection of the body after death, not just to go to heaven for the righteous and the wicked. And Jesus isn't only just the Messiah, but he's also the first fruits of the resurrection. He's the first person that was resurrected other than Lazarus. Well, I guess you could, there's probably other instances I should say that. But in terms of our resurrection being secure, our eternal future being secure, he is the first fruits for us. And so Jesus fulfills the law, and he proved it by being resurrected. Now, what else, can you think of anything else, any other reason Paul might have made this statement that he used this statement before for kind of strategic purposes?
He split them.
Yeah.
Well, the Sadducees.
That's exactly right. Yeah, remember that the Sanhedrin is made up of typically the priesthood, which is Sadducees, and they do not believe in the resurrection. The elders, the teachers, the scribes, the Pharisees do, and they're pitted against each other doctrinally, and so Paul might be kind of putting this thorn into the trial as well to make sure these guys aren't completely comfortable with themselves.
Well, what's the, for Tertullius, is he just a hired, like you said, a hired gun, or is he part of...
It's a good question. What do you think? Just out of curiosity. Do you draw any conclusions just from this passage of what he may be?
Well, I think he's had some relationship with them. obviously.
He sounds like a brown noser to me.
Yeah.
Probably hired him.
He does sound like a brown noser.
Yeah, well, but I would take a look at verse 6. I think that may answer the question.
So we seized him.
Yeah, I think he's probably a Jew. Mm-hmm. He's probably a Jew, but he's not. He's probably not a member of the Sanhedrin. He's probably a legal scholar. Think of if First Baptist had a trial, they might the congregation here might hire. They might want to hire a Christian attorney, someone that maybe is a member of the congregation. I think it's the same problem. Probably the same thing.
And the other question here is. With this particular court case, is this more of the circuit court, or is this
the trial court?
They're moving towards a federal?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is probably an appellate court to some degree in terms of level, because it really would have started with Claudius Lysias, and he had the discretion really to yield a judgment. And he probably would have had Paul not been a Roman citizen. Mm-hmm. It would have ended there. But Paul said, look, I'm a Roman citizen. Claudius was got afraid of that, so he sent him to this appellate level, which is kind of a, I guess you could call it, the Florida Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see now that Paul is going to appeal to the U.S. or the Roman Supreme Court, which is Caesar. We'll find that out later here.
Hmm.
Could someone read verses 20, or 16 through 21 at chapter 24?
So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonial clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. For those who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin, unless it was this one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. It is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today.
So yeah, Paul's starting to stir the pot here.
Yeah.
Paul makes a very interesting statement in verse 17. Take a look at verse 17. This might just get by if you don't look closely. What does he say in verse 17?
I think Paul, I may be totally wrong on this, but I think Paul was wealthy in his own right because of the tents that he made. His tents were top-notch tents, and
right.
He made a lot of money, so he gave a lot of that money to Jerusalem, and is that correct?
That is true. I would just say this, Lou, I think he was wealthy at one time. His family was definitely had a lot of dough.
Yes.
And he was doing work, tent making, tanning.
Right.
But I think he was poor from what, I don't want to say poor, I don't think he kept any money. I don't think he was building wealth. I think he was really giving it away,
right.
Remember, at the conclusion of the third missionary journey, he went to Jerusalem, and they literally took bags of dough with them that they had collected from all these churches to give to the believers in Judea who were starving, literally, who didn't have anything to eat, into widows. But he says, so that's a good point, but he says something else about, in verse 17, well, I'll give you this. He says, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation, present these offerings. So the point here is that, remember, the third missionary journey, we spent a lot of time on the third missionary journey. And it was about a 3-year duration. But if you read Acts, it literally is, from, one chapter to the next, it's over. And we talked about the fact that why was Luke so surreptitious? Why wasn't he forthright with accounting for this 3-year period of time? And we talked about the fact that it might have been this trouble that Paul got in with this emperor, this guy that was assassinated, a guy named Silenus. In Ephesus, and when Nero became emperor, if that just got discussed, because Nero's mother was responsible for assassinating Silenus, it may have connected Paul to the guy that got executed, and Paul might have been in trouble. So that's why this 3-year period is kind of another hidden period in Scripture, and we had to kind of tease through all the epistles and a lot of other information. But it was several years of duration. It was a long time. And so on this third missionary journey, saying in 17, I came back to Jerusalem. And he says, look, I wasn't doing anything. In verse 18, he says, there were these Jews from Asia. And he had a lot of problems in Asia being Ephesus. And they went nuts. And he also says something in verses 18 and 19. He makes a legal point in verses 18 and 19. Anyone observe the legal point that Paul's making?
Yeah, they should be there to accuse.
Isn't it interesting? The fundamental due process right we have today. You have the right, you're accused, you have the right to face your accusers. And that's basically the same thing he's saying. Look, it's one thing for me to be accused and to stand trial, but my accusers have to be present, and they're not there. And so Paul basically says that in verse 20, okay, these guys that are here can testify to you something. And he says, but they can't testify to the fact that I started a riot in it's hysterical. He's basically saying, here's their testimony. They can't testify that I started a riot in Temple, but they can testify that they did see a riot. It's the riot that they caused or they started when I basically made a simple statement.
Right.
And remember when he was there before the Sanhedrin, he said, I'm on trial for the resurrection, living and dead, and the Sanhedrin went nuts. I mean, they literally had to pull Paul out of there and they were fighting each other. And so Paul's basically saying, yeah, there was a riot, but it wasn't mine, it was theirs. And that's the point the very intelligent Paul of Tarsus is making here.
That's great. see all them being locked up in the room.
But let me just jump in for half a second here. I think a good salesman, a good politician, a good teacher, I think, knows how to disturb, because if you don't disturb people, they listen to your message and then they do things the way they happen to them. But a good
communicator
disturbs you, inspires you to change. And I think that's what Paul has been doing on this whole trip. So almost like a politician with a stump speech. When he got in front of these guys, he did what he does every day. And he's good at it. And he had the power of the Holy Spirit upon him. So I'm sure it was powerful.
It was probably making Tertullus pretty angry.
But I think he did this kind of thing all the time, except it was with how to be a believer.
In the synagogue discussions he had and the disputes, I think you're exactly right.
Was Tertullus possibly the one that was saying, or in that group, that was saying, these guys are Greeks in the...
Probably not. Literally was these guys. Because remember, they were there for Pentecost. The only reason some guys from Ephesus would have been in Jerusalem was for that feast.
Mm-hmm.
Once Pentecost is over, they go home. So the accusers probably are literally nowhere to be found at this point.
How similar, though, is his statement there about the resurrection, like yelling fire in a movie house? I mean, that's almost what he's done.
Yeah. There's a few doctrines in our own Christian belief system where you could make similar strong statements and people would be at each other's throats. But yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, people have very strong feelings one way or the other. And, you know, they're the leaders. These are the people that are basically crafting the doctrine. They're not just the believers in the doctrine. So they're really, you know, going to be, you know, and they're not operating out of love. I mean, they're not believers, of course. You know, they're operating out of jealousy, politics, and all those types of things. Let's take a look at verses 23 through 27, if someone could read those.
Yes, it's me.
Let's not be shy.
Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. When Lysias the commander comes, he said, I will decide your case. He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and said, that's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I will send for you. At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favor to the Jews, he let Paul in prison.
Okay. Felix...
definitely a politician.
Yeah.
Money.
Felix, exactly right. Felix historically was taken off. He was relieved of his duty by Emperor Nero in AD 60. Felix historically had a lot of problems with keeping Israel under control. There was a lot of rebellion going on. He overreacted a number of times, where he really cracked down on the Jewish population, and a lot of folks in the Sanhedrin, a lot of Jewish aristocracy, would go to Rome and say, "Look, this guy is a nutbag. You got to get him out of there." Nero, after hearing this time and time again, just gets tired of hearing and dealing with it, so he gets rid of Felix. Now, this is AD 60. 10 years from now, Jerusalem won't exist anymore, for all intents and purposes. Rome is going to come down on that city like Hiroshima in 10 years from this point. And so, from a historical context, as you look at secular history, Rome has a lot of problems, and the problems get worse and worse and worse until finally Rome comes to the point where they say, "We are just going to crush these people. We're tired of them." And so this is the beginning that Paul is here at the very seeds of this catastrophe, soon coming catastrophe about to come on in Israel.
Aren't we going through, we as Christians and we as the church, aren't we going through that right now?
Yes.
With our entire country, our administrations, our leaders, etc., are anti-Christ, anti-commitment to a Christian standard, etc., because of their liberality, etc., which of course points out a lot of what's happening here.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And they're greed. This guy, people that are in power in our country are greedy, typically. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in it for themselves. Felix was in this for himself.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys are just doing it, you know.
Right.
They're in the game because it's well paid. They can get some money on the side.
Mm.
Which is not a lot different than what's going on in this country.
That's
a good point.
Yeah.
Okay, take a look at this. What does Luke say about Felix in verse 22, this governor of Judea?
He knows the way.
What does he know?
More exact knowledge about the way.
This guy, Felix, knows what the teaching, what the doctrine, what the community, what the cult of Christianity is. He understands it. He has knowledge of it. And there's probably a lot of folks. In fact, when Luke says he has a more exact knowledge about the way, he may have known more about it than some of the guys in the Sanhedrin.
Well, as a leader, shouldn't he?
Well, yeah.
Maybe he was doing his job a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. But who's Felix's wife?
The Jewish.
That's right. So, you know, a lot of these people in power, when you read the New Testament, they flirt sometimes with salvation. And, you know, we don't know. Maybe they become saved later on.
Maybe.
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know. Okay, so verse 24... Felix says, "Look, I'm going to get Callistus to come down from Jerusalem, and we're going to figure this out." Verse 24, Drusilla arrives. Drusilla is a great-granddaughter of Herod the Great. Herod, who was king of Judea, he was a puppet king under the Roman government, and he actually had Bethlehem, all the males, slaughtered in Bethlehem because he didn't want a challenge to his throne. He was told by the wise men from Babylon that the Messiah was born, and Jesus survived that attempt. So Felix sends for Paul, and he wants to inquire more. He wants to hear right from Paul. He and his wife want to hear more about what Paul has to say about Jesus. What happens if something very, very interesting happens in verse 25? What happens in verse 25?
He became frightened.
Yeah. Why do you think he became frightened?
Did he start believing what Paul was saying?
Well, take a look. What was Paul saying?
Future judgment.
Bingo. You know, salvation is not just, you know, come to Jesus and float on a cloud in heaven. There's a lot of important reasons to come to know the Lord. But a reason we can't disqualify, or which they used to talk a lot about in the last century, which we don't talk a lot anymore, is judgment. You are facing some serious problems. Hell and brimstone preaching, you know, that used to be popular. you know, Paul talked about the fact that the righteous and the wicked will be judged according to a sovereign God on a basis of righteousness that we can't attain through the keeping of this Jewish law, which Felix was aware of and knew was pretty complicated. And so that freaked Felix out.
But if Felix was freaked out about that, then why in the next verse did he want, hoping to get money as bribes?
Well, let me ask you this. It's a good question. When he became frightened, what was his first reaction when he got scared?
You know,
shut up. Have any of you had this experience before where you're talking to someone and you're sharing and they get freaked out and you can tell it's not, they're just afraid. They're just like, whoa, that's too heavy. They want to shut it down. I think that's just what's happening here. This guy's conviction is falling upon this guy. He just wants to shut it down. Now, that doesn't change his personality. He's still greedy.
Right.
And so, therefore, he wants a bribe.
Gotcha, okay.
Why do you think he thinks Paul has money or access to it?
He should have been bringing it up.
He just bought a boatload in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Well, his education by how he speaks.
Bingo. And he's a Roman citizen. There's money somewhere.
And this guy,
you might not have it here in prison, but somewhere.
Well,
a lot of people know you and love you.
He traveled all over the place.
Let's grease the skids here. Yeah.
And Felix is Roman? He's Roman.
Yeah, he's a Roman governor.
But he's married to a Jew.
He's married to a Jew.
Okay.
He's married to Herod's. We're going to find out more about Drusilla in a second.
Okay.
Another thing we're going to find out, very interesting. Let me save that for our next passage. Very, very interesting.
Hey, Chris. Something I think is really cool is the fulfillment of the words of Jesus in this passage where he said, when the Spirit comes, what will he do? He'll convict of sin, righteousness, and judgment. And it says right here in this verse, you know, reason of temperance, righteousness, and judgment.
That's true.
So the Spirit of God is in this.
That's right. And Jesus told Paul, you're going to have an audience before kings and the Gentiles. And so here he is before, you know, and he's one step away from the emperor of Rome here. So this is a full fulfillment of what Jesus has told him. And so he's hoping for money. Paul is not going to pay a bribe. So what happens as a result of Paul's unwillingness to pay the bribe?
Left Paul in prison.
Yeah, for how long?
2 years.
Now, I think as we saw earlier, you know, this imprisonment wasn't a dungeon. It wasn't like his Ephesus imprisonment. It was like a house imprisonment. We'll talk about Rome. Paul's imprisonment in Rome. It's kind of like the same thing. So it wasn't as drastic as a dungeon. It was like a house arrest. But he was still imprisoned. He was still, you know, he wasn't released on his own recognizance. And he sat there for 2 years because Felix was waiting for some cha-ching.
Right. But it also says that they prevented from any of his friends from ministering to him. Is that in verse 23? Does that pertain to verse 27?
Yeah. Okay. Then gave orders to the security kept custody and yet have some freedom and not prevent. Okay. Yeah. So he didn't want his people. He didn't want. Why do you think Felix might allow people to see Paul?
For
money to come in.
Felix wants Paul to identify a mule.
Gotcha, okay.
To bring in the contraband.
Okay.
Now, it's interesting because here's another very prevalent doctrine or teaching, which I think is very true. 2 years. Who is writing this full account that we're reading?
Luke.
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah, Luke.
Oh, that's what I thought.
This is likely the time that Luke, as a physician and historian, spent in Israel going back and forth ministering to Paul, getting eyewitness testimonies, speaking to the mother of Jesus, the apostles, and gathering the information from which the Holy Spirit would help him to develop the life of Jesus Christ through the Gospel of Luke. So Luke is, through this particular time, the Lord is using this time to equip Luke to transmit to us the gospel in a very historic, accurate, and orderly way that survives to us this way.
So are you saying that he had to shut this Paul guy down, his activity, for a while so he could do the greater task?
That's a way to look at this. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And then it's just another example of sometimes we think things are going on in our own lives that aren't good, but God is using it, and we might not even know that until later for a bigger purpose. And sometimes just thinking about that can get you through a trial. And, you know, when you feel like giving up, sometimes the idea that something's going on that I can't see that God is going to use this for can get you to get some hope to get beyond that trial. And so being in prison for 2 years, even if it was just a house arrest, that's, you know, that's got to wear on you.
But I'll never forget, the real test of leadership, I think, is when that leader is then removed, are those students that were under them, do they rise up and keep going, or does the movement die? And I think here we're seeing that it kept going. And I think is it about you,
it's good,
or
right.
is it about the crusade?
Right.
There's good and bad in that.
Well, Hitler. It's a reality, though.
I know. I guess it is, because I just thought of Hitler. There's still a Hitler movement.
But it largely did die with his death. I mean,
I'm sorry?
It's not like Christianity, in fact, that when he went in.
They're still saying Heil Hitler. They're not saying Heil Joe.
Heil Joe.
Okay. Of course, Hitler said Jesus is alive.
So take a look at verse 27. Felix tries to wait for the bribe to come. Nero says, you're out of here. And what happens to Felix's job?
Placed.
Yeah, with it.
Festus,
so you got another. Pontius Pilate was in this the office. There's a few other guys. Ends up with Felix. Now it's Festus. Festus was appointed by Nero again right after Felix. This is secular history. He died in office 2 years later, so he doesn't last long here.
Do we know what happened to Felix and his wife?
No. But
don't you think that Felix was being convicted while his wife, being a Jew and everything else, and they were having these conversations and that type of thing, that he was becoming convicted more and more to Christ, and that's why he wanted money just to go ahead and, you know, he probably wanted a whole bunch of change or a lot of money and everything else, but he would have taken just a little bit to go ahead and say, well, okay, get out of here.
I don't know.
Because that's what I'm reading into this, is that you know, because it indicated in here that they were going ahead and conversing, it sounds like, several times and everything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, obviously the more time that you spend with someone, the more time you go ahead and really understand their story and that type of thing. And that's what I'm saying, is that, you know, Felix just wanted to get rid of Paul, you know, but he couldn't let him go without, you know, getting some money or something like that. But and then he sent his wife away. I think that's sort of interesting, because he got to a point where he started resisting it a little bit and everything else, and that, okay, just give me some money and I'll let you out of here now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That's a good guess.
I think his mother's goodness is weak.
Yeah, like a little weenie.
Yeah, a little weenie.
You know, we could be missing something important about Paul here, too, because if he did collect all this money, he probably could have sent Luke out or somebody and said, you know, get another offering and let's pay him off and I'll go out and do the Lord's work.
That's
he didn't take things into his own hands.
There you go.
Well, often I'll do that. You know, well, if I do this little thing that maybe isn't what God wants, I can go back and do God's work.
But Paul sat there for 2 years. Yeah, I can do God's work quicker my way.
That's an excellent
point. And maybe we didn't have the book of Acts.
Good point. That's good.
That is good. Okay, so now we got Festus in the picture, and we're in chapter 25.
Good job, Jeff.
Could someone read verses 1 through 5?
3 days after arriving in the province, Festus went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem, where the chief priests and Jewish leaders appeared before him and presented the charges against Paul. They urgently requested Festus a favor to them, to have Paul transferred to Jerusalem, for they were preparing an ambush to kill him along the way. Festus answered, "Paul is being held at Caesarea, and I myself am going there soon. Let some of your leaders come with me and press charges against the man there if he has done anything wrong."
Okay, so thanks, Paul. So again, just getting more of the same. Festus, I mean, poor Paul. Festus gets there. He's going through the casework. He finds this case of Paul. This guy's like, what do I do? So Festus goes up to Jerusalem to talk to the accusers to figure out what's going on. Check out verse 2. It's same deal. These guys are trying to get trick Festus to bring Paul from Caesarea back to Jerusalem in order to do what?
Killing him.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Everything. Same jigs going on. They want to get rid of Paul. So Festus basically says, no. Verse 4, he says, here's the deal. I'm going back. You guys, this is the charge. You get up, you get your heinies to the Capitol, and you present your case if there is any case against this guy. That brings us to verses 6 through 12. Could someone read verses 6 through 12? Paul volunteered. After he'd spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea, and on the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. Verse 7. After Paul arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. Verse 8. While Paul said in his own defense, quote, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. But Festus, close quote, but Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, quote, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? Verse 10. But Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you also very well know. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of these things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Verse 12. Then, when Festus had conferred with his council, he answered, you've appealed to Caesar you're going.
Oh, boy.
And so...
Does he regret saying that?
No. Well, again, this is all according to the will of God, the plan of God. Paul's defense here is, again, they haven't proved anything. Paul, you got to imagine, probably looks exasperated. He's been here for 2 years. This is going around and around. He says, look, you know these guys are... You know this is a scam. Festus probably doesn't have to. Festus is probably a lot like Felix. He wants to do the Jews a favor. You know he's not giving impartial justice here. And so I think Paul kind of reads into Festus is kind of the same joker as Felix was. It's kind of the same cloth. And so I think he finally just says, you know, look, you have the ability to do this. I don't need to spend another 2 years here. Send me to Caesar if you're not going to make a judgment. Now, here's where we get into an interesting area. Because now he actually has pushed Festus into a corner, or he's made Festus show his hand, because Festus may have been wanting to get some money out of this, like Felix. Paul says he appealed to Caesar. Notice he confers with his council. His council says legally, you know, you got to send him there. Now here's the problem Festus is going to run into. He sends someone, you know, the big guy, to the head honcho. He's going to waste his time, utilize his time to hear this case. What's the charge?
None.
That's the problem Festus runs into here. Crap. Paul has screwed me. You know, what do I do? Now he's got to go. And if the emperor finds out that I've sent this this guy with nothing, I mean, I'm going to lose my job.
It's not like a joke.
Because they've had all this time to go ahead and get the accusers back, and they still aren't produced.
And they're still, you know, they're not exactly even sure. That's not even sure what the charge is, even. You know, what's the deal? Why is this guy being threatened? Or why am I involved in this?
Why is it to that level and everything? Now
what does that mean?
Right.
Okay, so now...
Like the Senate Finance Committee trying to figure out a hedge fund. Did he pay a tax on that to the Romans? The gifts that he gave to the, the temple? Maybe that's...
Okay, we got some time here. I think we can get through this pretty good part here. Now, Festus does something that a lot of politicians typically do when they're caught in a problem, and we're going to find out about it here. Someone read verses 13 through 20.
Now when some days had passed, Agrippa, the king, and Bernice arrived at Caesarea to welcome Festus, and they stayed there for many days. Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a man left prisoner by Felix. And when it was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews gave information about him, asking for sentence against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. When therefore they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought in. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in this case of such evils as I supposed, but they had certain points of dispute with him about their own superstitions and about one Jesus, who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive.
And through 21, if you don't mind.
Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wished to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I commanded him to be held until I could send him to Caesar.
Okay, so let me give you some background information. This is good stuff. Let me get some background information. And the thing that is difficult about the New Testament is it's very easy for us to be confused by names, because there's a lot of names that are confusing. I mean, it's not like Tim Mulford or Chuck McKeever. It's like John the Baptist. Or, you know, these people don't have last names. You know, they have these family names. So there's some hard to keep track of. Similar to the name Herod, there's like a zillion different Herods you know, we read about in the New Testament. And it can be like, oh, daunting. Who is this guy? How does he relate? But when you really are able to, after some time and some study, figure out and make the connections of who these people are, it's fascinating how this all fits into how history has unfolded. And Herod the Great, let me give you some background on Herod the Great. Herod, who again had wanted to kill Jesus when he was born. Herod the Great was not a Jew by birth. He wasn't Jewish. He was an Idumean or an Edomite, which is a southern area. He's actually a descendant of Ishmael. But what happened was, well, it's good stuff.
I believe you.
And this is not from the New Testament. This is from secular history, like Josephus. But it's important to know, because you find out why all this intrigue is going on. But when Israel reasserted control over
the
nation,
can we get college credit for this?
What's that?
Can we get college credit for this? CEUs or something.
Look into that.
You got to take the test.
No. When Israel kind of got that control over their nation, about 100 years before Jesus was born, they were a very militaristic nation again. The priesthood was reestablished. The temple was rebuilt. Remember, they came back from Babylon. And they took military control of this province of Edom. And by force, they converted everyone to be Jews. They circumcised all the males. And they said, look, they imposed on their pagan culture the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Herod was part of this Edomite kingdom. And he was circumcised, probably his parents or the Jews, or his family. And so, yes, he became a Jew culturally and maybe even religiously, but he is not a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. And through some political intrigue that was going on, when Rome started to get re-involved in the rule of Israel, Herod kind of fought his way Herod was good friends with a guy named Mark Antony. Remember Mark Antony and Cleopatra?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Antony and Cleopatra had a big battle with Caesar Augustus, and they lost. Herod was afraid that he was going to go down because he was the loser's friend. Herod, being very smart politically, went quickly to Caesar Augustus and said, hey, I'm your bud. You know, brought him gifts. Caesar Augustus said, I like you. Go ahead and remain king. Be king over Israel. And so Herod, although he was king of Israel, king of Judea, the religious aristocracy, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, didn't really respect him because he wasn't a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, because he wasn't ethnically Jewish. But they recognized him because Rome recognized him as the king of the Jews.